Hudson right now. National Weather Service in Albany says it's dropped from 93 to 81 in the past hour. And it should cool down this weekend. Stay tuned.
My name is Matthew Vinnie Harrington. Next up on WGXC is All Together Now, a local show of information, news, weather, interviews, reports, email info at WGXC.org. to get involved with your creative community radio station.
Well done, Matthew.
Thank you.
You're listening to WGXC Acra, Hudson, Catskill.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. Andrea Mako reports for Porcupine Soup that on June 1st, a fuel oil spill was discovered in the Catskill Creek in Catskill. The Catskill Fire Company reported an approximate 500-foot sheen of fuel on the water near 119 Main Street along the creek in Catskill. A Department of Environmental Conservation spokesperson did not get back to the newspaper in time for their story. The day before, the DEC did have a statement about a different mystery oil in the Hudson River, May 28th, saying it was, and I quote, an apparent petroleum spill causing a sheen on the Hudson River in and around Coxsackie, end quote. Read more about this story in Porcupine Soup. Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that Governor Kathy Hochul announced on June 1st that New York high school seniors will now receive automatic acceptance to community colleges. State University of New York Chancellor John King first outlined the plan during his State of the University address this week. Hochul said, and I quote, "My administration remains committed to removing barriers and easing the pathway to higher education for all high school seniors, lifting up students to build a brighter future for themselves and New York," end quote. King said, and I quote, "There is a place for every New Yorker at SUNY, and we are excited to make college an easy decision because our high school seniors and their parents understand their options," end quote. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. Noah Zweifel reports in the Altamont Enterprise that Cornell University researchers found that many upstate New York residents don't believe upstate New York is getting a fair shake with the proliferation of solar facilities and is another example of upstaters shouldering the burden for downstaters' needs. The study says, and I quote, "Solar energy is usually described as a promising and clean technology and is often touted as a key response to the climate crisis. But the growing trend of developing utility-scale solar sites in rural places highlights how solar can recreate energy production and consumption patterns between rural and urban society. Patterns which historically have contributed to spatial inequities," end quote. The study also found the correlation between political affiliation and opposition to solar farms was insignificant. Read more about this story in the Altamont Enterprise. Wave Farms Public Art Park begins opening Saturdays on June 3rd for drop-in visits anytime between noon and 6 p.m. The art park is on Wave Farms' 29-acre campus in Acre, featuring 13 installations. The study center, including a research library, the WGXC 90.7 FM Acre broadcast studio, and accommodations for Wave Farms International Artist Residency Program. Visitors to Wave Farms Art Park receive a guided tour of the campus. Admission is free, and tours typically last between 60 and 90 minutes. The art park is available to see on other days through October through reservations at wavefarm.org. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Is it everything I wanted? No. But sitting with one house, with a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic president who didn't want to meet with us, I think we did pretty dang good for the American public.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said history was made with the passage of the debt limit spending bill in the House. The legislation raises the debt limit until December 2024 and restrains discretionary spending over the next decade. The bill now heads to the Senate. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said they'd get the bill to President Joe Biden's desk as soon as possible.
Time is a luxury the Senate does not have if we want to prevent default. June 5th is less than 4 days away. At this point, any needless delay or any last-minute holdups would be an unnecessary and even dangerous risk.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell welcomed the debt limit spending bill with its projected $1.5 trillion in cuts, saying it makes the most serious headway in years toward curbing Washington Democrats' reckless spending addiction. McConnell called the level of defense spending disappointing.
So while the coming votes are an important step in the right direction, we cannot neglect our fundamental obligation to address the nation's most pressing national security challenges.
The Senate passed a measure to overturn President Biden's student debt relief program, which aimed to forgive up to $20,000 in student loans for more than 40 million people. Observers say the president is likely to veto the bill, in part because elements of the plan remain under consideration by the conservative-leaning Supreme Court. Democratic Senators John Tester of Montana and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, alongside Arizona Independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema, joined Republicans to cut Biden's proposal. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis made his debut as a Republican presidential candidate in Iowa Tuesday, rallying after a glitch-filled launch on Twitter. While DeSantis did not mention former President Donald Trump by name, he intensified his criticism of the former president.
A leadership is not about entertainment. It is not about building a brand. It is not about virtue signaling. Leadership is about producing results for the people that you represent.
On the first day of Pride Month, Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes took to Twitter to say it is more important than ever. Elected officials and state offices work to protect and promote the civil rights of LGBTQ+ Arizonans.
I am a supporter and ally, a friend and a family member, and I want to make sure that folks feel good, feel safe, and supported.
According to a new survey by the advocacy group GLAAD, 9 out of 10 heterosexual Americans support LGBTQ+ rights. The organization says it could be a sign the GOP strategy of targeting LGBTQ+ Americans may backfire with voters in upcoming elections. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Wednesday, the Connecticut Senate passed a bill implementing 14 days of in-person early voting, and the state is likely to join 46 other states with an early voting option. The bill now goes to Governor Ned Lamont, who is expected to sign it. Early voting has had a challenging road in Connecticut, starting with a proposed modification of absentee voting rules in 1994. Attempts at allowing voting by mail and no-excuse absentee all failed, in part because the state constitution didn't grant the legislature power to change the manner of voting. In 2014, a constitutional amendment allowing early voting and no-excuse absentee failed 52-48%. Finally, in 2022, voters approved a constitutional measure 61-39%, giving the legislature the power to legislate early in-person voting. The bill passed June 1st codifies that ballot measure. The bill allows for 14 days of in-person early voting before a general election, beginning the 15th of the month prior to the election and ending 2 days before Election Day. It also provides for 7 days of early voting for most state primaries and 4 days for presidential primaries and special elections. Connecticut's actions leave only New Hampshire, Alabama, and Mississippi without early voting options. We have more on early voting, groups taking action, and a sign-up for our free daily email at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
We got a better weather special report for you. Even though a lot of places, it is bright and sunny right now, there are storm cells forming, and they are forming quickly. They are dropping lightning in places to the west of us, and pretty soon that could be right over on top of us. If a storm hits you, there's a good chance you might not see it coming. So if you are outside, make sure that shelter is at least an option for you to take if you are not already headed there already.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Neva Wartell of Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Wave Farm respectfully and humbly acknowledges the past, present, and future Indigenous peoples on whose ancestral lands Wave Farm and WGXC operate and broadcast. The Mohicans name themselves the people of the waters that are never still following their arrival along the Great Ebb Tide River, also known as the Hudson. The Mohicans stewarded this land over many generations and in dynamic communication and interaction with diverse Indigenous peoples, including the Haudenosaunee Mohawk and the Munsee Lenape. Mohican descendants today live in communities in Ontario, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma. For more information on Mohican history and the contemporary community of the Stockbridge-Munsee Band of Mohican Indians, please visit Mohican.com.
Wave Farm's Public Art Park begins opening Saturdays on June 3rd for drop-in visits anytime between noon and 6 p.m. The Art Park is on Wave Farm's 29-acre campus in Accra, featuring 13 installations. The Study Center, including a research library, the WGXC 90.7 FM Accra Broadcast Studio, and accommodations for Wave Farm's International Artist Residency Program. Visitors to Wave Farm's Art Park receive a guided tour of the campus. Admission is free, and tours typically last between 60 and 90 minutes. The Art Park is available to see on other days through October through reservations at wavefarm.org.
Did you know that you can get free ebooks from your library anytime, anywhere? Check out with your library card and enjoy on popular devices like an iPad, e-reader, and smartphone. Visit your library's website or download the Overdrive Media Console mobile app to get started today.
Wave Farm's Public Art Park begins opening Saturdays on June 3rd for drop-in visits anytime between noon and 6 p.m. The Art Park is on Wave Farm's 29-acre campus in Accra, featuring 13 installations. The Study Center, including a research library, the WGXC 90.7 FM Accra Broadcast Studio, and accommodations for Wave Farm's International Artist Residency Program. Visitors to Wave Farm's Art Park receive a guided tour of the campus. Admission is free, and tours typically last between 60 and 90 minutes. The Art Park is available to see on other days through October through reservations at wavefarm.org.
And, our guests are here. And
hi.
But come on in. Sit here.
Hello. I'm Sila.
This is Dante Puleo.
Puleo.
And
he
I don't
want to say anything that sounds Italian. Show. Are you Italian?
Italian. Yeah.
Dante Puleo.
We
Puleo,
happen,
right?
My people happen to be great dancers. You ever hear of Edward Villella? Is that a thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
You had to check.
Yeah.
With a real Italian.
Italian?
I think so. wait, there's another guy.
That's a person.
No, he
you know,
is.
I don't think this is doing our guest justice, unless he's trying to get a tan. It is really...
Well, it's good that they sweat, so they, you know, because you're putting them under the hot seat.
Is that what we're doing?
Well, we are now.
That wasn't the plan, but it sort of worked out.
Oh,
okay.
No.
So, Am is here to tell us about the whole cat. What's your actual title with the Catspan?
I am the artistic associate at the Catspan Cultural Park.
Fancy title.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Yeah. You know. Mm-hmm.
Artistic coat. What did you say? Associate.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's sort of like I had this poetry professor in college who was called a nature poet, and he didn't like that title.
Ooh.
But he said he'd take the adjective as long as he had the noun. And I just like the artistic.
Who was that guy?
His name is Eamon Grennan.
Oh, yeah.
Very good. Very
anyway,
good.
Anyway, but yeah, I'm here to talk about Catspan, not his poetry.
Right.
Oh, why not? Okay. Adam, as you know, lives not far from here, but he is.
I didn't know, but you know. Thank you for the reminder.
Well, I like to DOS people. As
I noticed.
Ever since I learned that word, I like to do it.
You do it
I didn't give the number of the street.
No, of course not.
I know. But he has brought with him Dante Paleo, who is the artistic director of the Jose Limon
Dance
Company. And your group is the first performers this summer at the dance part of Catspan. Kicking it off. How appropriate for a dance group, right?
Yeah.
Is there like a line of kickers?
You got one of those sound effects.
Yeah, it's hard when we're out in the wilds to use our sound effects.
We can pull them back a little bit, Tom. I feel bad that they're in the sun.
Boy, aren't you the nice person? But I'm not. Okay, move it back.
Thank you.
Okay.
I just like to be a gracious host. I don't know about you.
No, I don't. I couldn't care less about being gracious.
Unbelievable.
So,
is that better?
Yeah. Thank you.
A little bit. No, Mr. Paleo.
How many, they're nighttime performances?
Sort of, right? 6 p.m.?
6 p.m.
No, I'd call that night. Well, you know, it's not dark.
Evening.
But it's evening.
Yeah, I like
perfect.
Evening.
Mm-hmm. And are you one of the performers as well, or the choreographer, or both?
No, neither? I just stand in the back and I tell people what to do.
Oh, like the...
The conductor?
Yeah.
Sort of. Okay. Yeah.
And it's a bit of a shame because Dante, back in the day, was one of the most extraordinary dancers I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
But I will say he's brought that to his artistic leadership because the company right now looks stronger than I've ever seen it.
Thank you.
Now, are these performances that were choreographed by Jose Limon?
They were.
Ah,
who is Jose Limon?
Oh, that's a good question.
So Jose Limon was born in Mexico in the early 1900s. He immigrated to the United States as a young person and then moved to New York thinking he was going to be a painter.
Oh.
And then he went to an art show and saw the work that he always wanted to paint and go, well, that's what I thought I wanted to do.
Oh, no.
It's already been done.
Yeah.
So then he was introduced to dance. Then he started dancing. And then his whole artistic... A medium was shaped through movement.
Interesting.
And that's how he came to dance.
Is this your dance company showing up here? Or? No?
Hello.
Not my group.
Okay. Open back there, you can hang out. And if you're really ambitious,
here.
You'll come on our radio show at some point.
Hey!
Oh, look at all. Suddenly, people. See, Celia, you show up and everybody else shows up.
I know.
What does that tell you?
I bring the vibe.
Nobody. You do. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's it.
So, Limon fashioned himself an artist who actually is an artist because dance is an art.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. So he just shifted.
Yeah, he shifted mediums. He found dance, found movement, and then found the right people to help craft his eye and teach him some of the, just how to shape bodies and bring them into space and move space and move the bodies into space.
Won't be too much.
Oh, yeah.
They're building a stage over there.
Perfect.
So
perfect.
In the future, you can perform right there.
And come on, and put a little burlesque on.
I don't know how much space you need for the dance company.
So what kind of dance did Limon start with? Or
modern dance.
He was known for modern dance?
Yes. He was one of the greatest performers of his time.
Wow.
And that was during the late...
I'm going to look him up.
Early, 30s. In the 40s, 1930s and 40s. And then he started making his own work. One of his first solos is what we'll be seeing at Catspan. It's called Chacon. His understanding of how to tell stories and his way to shape bodies through space, I think, were just so fascinating. So the company's been around for 77 years.
It's got great bone structure.
Bone structure.
Wow.
And so the company is devoted solely to his... The dances that he choreographed?
The work we'll be seeing at Catspan is two of his works, but the company itself, we're a repertory company.
Okay.
So we do works by Jose Limon, and then we pair the works with commissioned choreographers, emerging, acclaimed choreographers, and then those works are in conversation with each other.
Do you feel any obligation that the works you commission or perform sort of correspond to what Jose Limón's aesthetic was?
Maybe not the aesthetic, but thematically.
Well, so, he's got a Limón technique, right?
His Limón technique, correct.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I could Google too, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I gotta be a part because you just keep talking.
So yes, the dancers study the technique, and they use the technique, which helps them in a variety of forms. It's part of a bigger practice.
It looks like capoeira a little bit. Hmm. That one little.
With the wood?
Oh, I see. Yeah,
right.
A little bit, yeah.
What?
Right.
Why don't you
go ahead and explain.
Capoeira.
Go ahead and explain.
I didn't know you were a dance maven.
I don't feel I have enough information to give you.
So it's a form of Brazilian street fight, but it also encompasses dance moves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's really popular. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what have you been fighting down in Brazil?
No, I'm going to be fighting you, Tom. I've been practicing to fight you.
So what are the actual details of when and what days you're performing and the times?
Yeah, so tomorrow we kick off, not with a dance performance, but an art opening, because we have an installation in our gallery and across our campus. It's 153 acres in Tivoli, New York.
It's a little risky on Pride weekend, isn't it?
Well, you know...
to have to split hairs. Hello?
Could be part of the event, right?
He's shipwrecked. Sorry about that.
One can do all the things.
There we go.
And we are also feeling our pride over at Cotspun. But so tomorrow we have this gallery opening, lots of nice food and wine and art. That'll be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday, Sunday at 6 p.m. on our mountain stage, we'll host these performances with the Limón Dance Company and also the American Ballet Theater Studio Company.
Ooh.
And I think it's a really nice pairing because the Limón Company is bringing these masterworks from the modern dance canon, and American Ballet Theater Studio Company is bringing some classical works that are some even older than the modern dance, and then some very new and contemporary works.
Nice. Wow.
So it builds a nice sort of
palette.
Yeah.
Dance.
And if people want to get tickets, you can't mention prices, but where do they go?
They go to kotspan.org. That is KAATSBAAN.org.
Yeah. What is Kotspan?
It's a mouthful.
What does that word refer to?
It is from the Dutch.
What are you looking at me like that for?
No reason, Tom. Keep going.
One of the co-founders of Kotspan about 30 years ago. She is Dutch, and it translates as a playing field.
Mm.
So they were kind of inspired by that idea, and we have these outdoor events, and it felt like a game.
That's cute.
Cool. So there's all kinds of things happening there, and amazingly, I've heard that, tell me this has to be a rumor, that our own Thursday afternoon show, Celia Graham, is going to be there for something.
I don't think it's a rumor, Tom. It's hard fact.
Oh, hard fact. We're very excited.
Yes.
When you say we, who exactly?
Everyone. Although I can't take credit for creating that panel, we invited Tamar Adler to put together a...
That explains it. Your BFF.
One of my BFFs.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
But, you know, Tamar just published this book about...
We had her here.
Okay, great.
Everlasting Meal.
And so, this panel celebrates different cultural traditions around food storing and saving. And
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that this one here is mentioned in the book.
Unbelievable.
That's right, folks. Celia Graham is mentioned in Tamar Adler's new cookbook. Okay? Have I done it justice now?
I don't know. You keep talking.
Okay. You've curated the whole dance program.
That's right.
And how many...
In conversation with other members of the team, but...
Right. And how many different groups are coming in?
Yeah, so we're serving up 3 weekends of world-class art, dance, film, music, and more. Is how I like to describe it.
That's right, and more.
And so, week one features this art opening and these dance performances with the Limón Company and ABT Studio Company.
Nice.
Week two, we have the acclaimed string quartet Ethel, along the wild violinist Curtis J. Stewart, who just won his 3rd Grammy nomination. Saying. And also that weekend, we have a dance performance featuring the Trisha Brown Dance Company. Along with New Jersey Ballet and an up-and-comer named Roderick George, who I think is really somebody to watch. And week three, we're featuring a panel of local dancers and choreographers, which is going to be very exciting, in collaboration with Hutsi TV, great organization. And
does that include you?
Well, I'll be moderating the panel. So in a way, yes. Although the three dancers are Ralph Mvore from Newburgh, who's very cool hip-hop artist, a flamenco dancer, Anna Labrada George, who runs Hudson Valley Flamenco Festival.
Mm, that sounds cute.
And Livia Vanover, who, you know, she's sort of a Hudson Valley folklorico staple. Love her.
Interesting.
And some other cute things. We're slipping in a walk that Wild Gather is leading, because we have this big, beautiful campus, and we would just love to kind of help people explore it more thoroughly. And finally, we have performances, which were a collaboration between Emily Coates and Emmanuel Fuon, who are both wildly talented dance makers. And that'll be cool. It's half in our indoor theater, half outdoors, and it weaves together traditional Cambodian dance, astronomy, ecology, in ways that are hard to describe, but I think will make for a fascinating show.
And
yeah, I want to get more of our Hudson peeps down there, so I'm so grateful for you having us on.
Where is it exactly?
So Tivoli, New York, you can get there. It's like a 15-minute drive down 9G.
Did you say 15?
15, 1-5.
Okay.
Very close.
Yeah, I guess it is.
You can also get
more
there
like
by boat.
Hour.
Or
did I'd you go. Say half hour?
Yeah.
Jesus.
I drive slow.
You're more than slow, honey. It's about 15 minutes.
But, you know, so Katzbahn, for many years, was primarily like a residency space where artists would come to develop new work.
That's right.
It wasn't so much a public-facing organization. So even though it's been around for 30 years, I talk to so many people who don't even know it's there.
Right.
So I feel like a part of what I'm excited about is
opening it up. That's right.
Excellent.
Yeah. I mean, and that's like one of the things that this area is happy to do and see is that people are opening up. They're showcasing, they're offering space and walks. All these things are all happening. It's so nice.
Yeah.
So, we're talking with Adam Weiner, who's the associate.
The artistic associate.
Artistic associate of Katzbahn. And Dante Kaleo, who's the artistic director of the Jose Limon Company, who will be the first performers at Katzbahn starting tomorrow night.
The first performance is on Saturday,
Saturday
6
sorry,
p.m.
Saturday.
And 6 you can get your tickets.
Which is June 3rd.
June 3rd and 4th.
June 3rd. Good. That's good. Quick.
Yeah, Katzbahn.org.
Nice.
Katzbahn.org. I just heard the name.
This is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm here with an important message from Natasha Pernica of the Food Pantries for the Capital District. Natasha, in my email today, I got a video from you about the challenges the food pantries are facing. Tell us a little bit about that.
I would love to, and thank you so much for having me today. Unfortunately, we all know that food is a basic need, and it's been very challenging since COVID. However, hunger didn't stop when the COVID emergency ended. In fact, here in New York's Capital Region, as a coalition of nearly 70 food pantries, first quarter already, we're seeing a 30% increase in community need. We're seeing people who have never had to turn to food pantries before, people who have children and both parents are working. We've had seniors coming because their SNAP benefits have been decreased. We're really in a difficult situation right now.
When you say SNAP, I think people know that that's the replacement for food stamps. One of the things that I thought was interesting was the difference between the emergency needs in the past and the regular supplement because of the financial challenges people face.
People use food pantries because they don't have enough resources, and food pantries provide groceries. You're coming away with a minimum of 3 days worth of food. Some pantries do more than that. And it's based on the MyPlate model. So you're getting proteins, grains, fruits and vegetables, dairy. Some people turn to food pantries for a short-term crisis. They got laid off, their car broke down, and they have very limited resources. So they're helping to get through. Other people turn to food pantries every month because they just don't have sustainable resources. And so every month, the food pantries help them get by. And we're now seeing more and more people not being able to get by on a monthly basis.
You mentioned the COVID changes. That happened at both the individual level of the end of the COVID bump in SNAP benefits, but also at a higher level of the end of support for food banks.
Yeah. So unfortunately, while food pantries, not just in the Capital District, but across the state of New York, are experiencing extreme increases, the COVID emergency ended, which means there's less free food coming from federal through the food bank system as there was during COVID. Most of the food that pantries have to acquire from the food bank, there's a cost associated with it. So costs are going up for food pantries because not only do food pantries acquire food at the food banks, but they also have to turn to grocery stores. Sometimes it can be cheaper to get things on sale at a grocery store. And we also have inventory challenges in the supply chain still. So everything that food pantries want to distribute out to the community is not always available. So we have less federal funding coming through to the food bank system as during COVID. We also have less state funding coming through to food pantries. And while in the state budget, the two programs that fund food for our charitable food system, both the food banks and food pantries, Nourish New York and HPNAP, the Hunger Prevention Nutrition Assistance Program through Department of Health, they're both incredible programs to help pantries and food banks buy for food. However, with food inflation being at even 10% for a lot of the pantry staple items, this flat funded budget is actually at an $8 million net loss if you take into consideration inflation over last year. So pantries are basically having to do more with less resources. I mean, you know, when you go to the grocery store, food prices are still high. And the food prices are not high because the companies have a need. I recently saw an article that said the four major food corporations in America are actually seeing billions of dollars record profits right now. It's honestly very disturbing. So we've got basically everything working against the food pantries right now. And we're really trying to reach out to the community to say, can you please come together? We've been actively working to deliver this message to the government, but it can take time for those resources to come through. And we're hopeful. We know the state cares and we know they want to do the right thing, but sometimes these things can take time. And right now, we have a large number of people turning to food pantries.
I want to go back a little bit to the structure of the food distribution. Can you talk us through what the system is like? What's the difference between the food bank, a food pantry, and then the food pantries for the Capital District?
Sure. We're all working together to help end hunger. The food pantries, the individual food pantries, like I mentioned, there's almost 70 food pantries in our coalition. So the Food Pantries for the Capital District is a coalition of about 70 food pantries. And these food pantries, if you are a person in need of food, you would go to a food pantry to get food. Many of them are located in churches. About 50% are totally volunteer run. Other food pantries are located in larger human services organizations and might have some paid staff, but still rely heavily on volunteers. So those are the food pantries. So where do the food pantries get their food from? About 60 to 80% of the food that food pantries distribute comes from food banks. So here in the Capital Region, we have one food bank, and they get food from the government, the USDA food, which is free. We can get free produce. And then most of the food pantries has a cost associated with it, whether it's a shared maintenance fee or co-op, which is basically like shopping wholesale. So pantries couldn't do it without the food bank because their dollars can go a lot farther paying for food at the food bank than going to a grocery store and having to rely on paying retail prices.
That brings us to the idea of what are ways that individuals can help meet the need and what are the best ways to do it? What are some of the options?
Yeah, pantries' dollars can definitely go farther in the long run because they do get most of their food from the food bank. So if you are able to support food pantries through financial contributions, that is a huge help. After that is to find out what do your local food pantries need. And food drives can be helpful, especially if you're going to a store and you see a sale, load up on things. Some of the staple items that food pantries really appreciate are canned meals, like soups, stews, things that are easy for kids to eat, you know, boxed meals, cereal, canned fruits and vegetables. Just look in your own pantry and see, you know, what do you keep in your pantry, and bring those things down to a local food pantry. The other thing that is really appreciated, especially by people visiting food pantries for assistance, is things like dish detergent, laundry detergent, personal hygiene products, deodorant, toothpaste. SNAP, or what was formerly called food stamps, doesn't cover those kind of items, and they can be very expensive. And usually food pantries themselves don't spend money on those items because they're focused more on food. But people in the community really appreciate being able to walk away with those items as well. And volunteering. If you are someone especially who can dedicate regular time, pantries use volunteers as a labor force. And while I talk about like the one and done, like one time show up and volunteer can be helpful, most pantries volunteer needs are more for a regular, steady person that they can train to do a specific task and really be a part of the regular team. If you are wanting to get involved, the food pantries for the Capital District can help find a food pantry for you to volunteer at. You can go to our website, thefoodpantries.org, and we can help you get involved.
Your website has information on if you want to donate, if you want to volunteer, and especially if you need food. What are the locations of the food pantries? Where can you go? When can you go? Any other information in our final moment that you want to mention?
I just have to say thank you so much for including me in your program. I know that we all care. We have an incredibly generous community, and a lot of people are going through hardship right now. If you're able to help, please do. And also, if you are a person who reaches out to your public representatives, please share this message with them. They really need to hear that this is a major crisis right now. We really appreciate that.
I hope that this helps. So that was Natasha Pernica from the Food Pantries for the Capital District. Their website again is thefoodpantries.org. Natasha, thank you for everything that you and your crew do.
Thank you.
The Public News Service Doha Newscast, June the 2nd, 2023. I'm Mike Clifford. But a new awareness campaign from a grassroots group in Wisconsin calls into question the voting patterns of two members of the state's congressional delegation.
Opportunity Wisconsin contends that Republican Representatives Brian Steil and Derek Van Orden aren't putting the needs of their constituents first. The group's Megan Rowe says many Wisconsin families are still struggling with financial pressures, such as higher consumer costs. With that in mind, she feels their elected representatives need to be held accountable if their votes are seen as creating more barriers for household budgets.
Are they fighting for everyday working people they represent, or are they prioritizing corporations?
The bipartisan debt ceiling deal was touted as a way to avoid an economic disaster amid steep budget cut demands from House Republicans. I'm Mike Moen.
That debt ceiling deal does expand work requirements for some recipients of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, but it also adds exemptions for others who rely on the support. Next, from the Washington Post, there is not enough groundwater underneath the Phoenix metropolitan area to meet projected demands over the next century. It's a finding that could threaten the current home building boom in outer suburbs that are among the fastest growing in the U.S. Those numbers based on an analysis of the groundwater supply released on Thursday. The Post says the report from the Arizona Department of Water Resources amounts to a chilling warning for the nation's fifth largest city and a metropolitan area with more than 5 million people. Meantime, the Nevada hunting and fishing community have shared their top 10 conservation priorities for 2023 with the governor there, Joe Lombardo.
The priorities range from supporting science-based management techniques to conserving big game corridors and seasonal habitats. President of the Coalition for Nevada's Wildlife, Larry Johnson, says wildfires present the greatest adverse impacts to wildlife populations in Nevada. He adds, in a bad wildfire year, the state can burn over 1 million acres.
Unfortunately, at our lower elevations and everything but our very high elevations, those wildfires, we destroy the native vegetation and it is taken over by invasive species, such as cheatgrass.
Johnson says cheatgrass is not only poor wildlife forage, but is also fuel for wildfires. According to Johnson's group and the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, nearly one quarter of the approximately 20 million acres of priority and greater sage-grouse habitat in Nevada has burned in the last 30 years. Great sage-grouse numbers have also significantly dropped by almost 80% in the Great Basin since 1960. I'm Alex Gonzalez reporting.
This is Public News Service. Now to Illinois, where some real estate corporations are getting large paydays by charging homeowners assessments for common expenses. And those owners allege they are taking advantage of the Illinois Condominium Property Act.
Owners in a building along Chicago's lakefront say they are being pushed out of their homes and cannot afford the new building owner's fees, which they say are unreasonable. At Chicago City Hall, Tiana James Harris, a 13-year homeowner with condo owners of Woodland Park, demanded assistance to fight what she calls unjust displacement.
So they have things like landscaping, which they spent like $100,000+ on. In the past two budgets where we've had special assessments, there were the same items in both budgets that never got taken care of. They're trying to push us out because they want our property.
The condo owners have joined forces with the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization and are proposing changes to the state's Condominium Property Act, to Farah Siddiqui reporting.
And the Keystone State's general election is less than 6 months away now. A nonpartisan organization is already getting the word out to residents about the importance of voting and voter registration.
Pennsylvania has more than 8.7 million registered voters, but it's estimated the voter turnout during the municipal primary election was only 27.5%. Becky Wise is president of the League of Women Voters of Westmoreland County. She says they are hoping to see a better turnout in November.
The turnout was very light in Westmoreland County. I looked up the newspaper accounts of it, and the overall turnout for the primary was 29%. But that's up from 24.5% in 2019, when many of the same races were on the ballot.
They're committed to having vote411.org set up for Westmoreland County in time for the general election. For Public News Service, I'm Danielle Smith.
Finally, our Eric Tegenoff lets us know a rally held in Salem Thursday to urge passage of a bill that would provide food assistance to Oregonians regardless of their immigration status.
Senate Bill 610, known as Food for All Oregonians, would ensure people who are undocumented and excluded from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program receive food aid in the state. Morgan Dewey is with Oregon Food Bank.
The Capitol was a beautiful backdrop for a series of speakers who shared their personal stories, organizations that are part of the 125-plus organization-led coalition supporting Food for All Oregonians.
Senate Bill 610 would extend aid to lawful permanent residents, U.S. Compacts of Free Association citizens, and other Oregonians who arrived as immigrants or refugees.
This is Mike Clifford. Thank you for wrapping up your week with Public News Service. Hear us on interesting radio stations, your favorite podcast platform, and you can always find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Pedro Snyder reports in the Times Union that tender dry conditions and the fluffy white seeds of cottonwood and poplar seeds are creating wildfires in the Hudson Valley. On June 1st, there were still wildfires in Gilderland, Rotterdam, and Schenectady, accelerated by the cottonwood and poplar seeds that have blanketed the ground. John Keimer, public information officer for the Westmere Fire Department, said, and I quote, "If it ignites this snow-like material, it takes off. It's like gasoline," end quote. Little to no precipitation has fallen locally for the past 10 to 14 days, according to Brett Rathbun, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Albany. Rathburn said, and I quote, "With the combination of it being that warm and that dry for so long, any little ignition source could call for some brush fires," end quote. Rotterdam, for instance, declared a water emergency this week with a ban on all outdoor water use through the weekend. Cooler temperatures and rain are forecast locally, and John Keimer, public information officer for the Westmere Fire Department, said, and I quote, "Hopefully brush season will end shortly," end quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that Governor Kathy Hochul announced on June 2nd that 24 land banks across New York will receive nearly $26 million in funding to expand housing in the state. Hochul said, and I quote, "New York's land bank initiative has already allowed us to preserve, restore, and revitalize rundown properties across the state, and we are excited to be extending the opportunity this year. This program will empower local nonprofits, the people that know their communities best, to help increase home ownership while repairing the fabric of their neighborhoods," end quote. Hochul had wanted to expand affordable housing throughout New York in the state budget with a plan to add 800,000 units over the next 10 years that was shot down by the legislature. Officials are hoping the money for the land bank plan will help create or preserve 100,000 affordable homes in New York. Read more about this story in New York State of Politics. Mid-Hudson News reports that Ulster County-based Assemblyperson Sarah Hanna Streshta has introduced legislation aimed at Central Hudson to strengthen accountability measures against alleged wrongdoings by utilities. The Democrat Socialist from his office wants consumer utility protections during investigations that would prohibit gas, electric, telecommunications, and water companies from charging late fees or terminating service when the utility is being investigated by the State Public Service Commission. Shrestha said, and I quote, "It should not be up to them to decide when to suspend late fees when they are being investigated. We want to make sure this is guaranteed, and we also want to make sure that this is clearly communicated to the customers," end quote. Shrestha says with the legislature soon winding down that the bills won't be taken up until January. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, June 2nd. It's warm summer, so hurricane season has begun. And this one has a low confidence of accuracy. La Nina is expected to show up sometime, likely in early fall. Hopefully that gives us a mild but slightly wet summer. And yes, that is your seasonal prediction. Slightly wet and somewhat mild. Local early morning temperatures range from 53 degrees in Steventown to 63 up in Tannersville. Regional average soil temperature is 63 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be high and trees are the primary offenders. Comfort levels today fall off after 9 a.m. At noon, chances of rain arrive and it's bringing some lightning to lunch. Expect randomly stormy conditions all afternoon. We get a high of 89 at 2 p.m. Temperatures drop below 75 by dark, but a dew point in the 60s is going to make things feel a bit muggy. A low temperature of 61 happens just after dawn on Saturday. Light rain continues most of the day, tapering off by 4 p.m. A high of 68 happens at 3 p.m. Overnight, stays dry and we get a comfy low of 55 degrees. Sunday will definitely be the better day to get outside. Dry, partly cloudy, high of 72. Monday looks like rain comes back in the afternoon and we get a high of 72. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 2:02 a.m., low tide at 8:55 a.m., high tide again at 2:25 p.m., and low tide once again for 8:52 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 70 degrees. We are on a steady incline, and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 8:18 p.m. No, I'm sorry, that is the time for everybody else. Us folk that have to contend with mountains will see the sun go down around 8:10 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:18 a.m. Looking way up, we see we are still in a minor geomagnetic storm watch. Plasma winds will be slow at 394 kilometers per second, with a thin density of 3 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 4 megahertz till dark, then fair across the board overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3.3, quiet. The current sunspot number is 143, and this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Hi, everybody. My name is Daniel Thomas Wachowski. Tune in to the local news for better weather, interviews with your friends and neighbors, and more on WGXC from 7 to 10 every morning. WGXC is here to start your day with democracy now at 8. Tune in weekdays to 90.7 FM to get your morning going.
I'd say, do you say, I do, I'd say.
Okay. I'm going to move my mic around to hear parts of the engine. Where I'm about to put the mic is where all the valves are. It's noisy. It sounds like a sewing machine.
This is tongue and cheek. Exercises for warming up our ways of communicating. First Tuesdays of every month, 2 to 3 p.m. on WGFC Waveform Radio.
Now move to 12 and try to get that same.
Tongue in Cheek is voiced and led by Tim Simmons, Aaron Lehman, and Emma McCormick Goodhart.
Show with the top cut off of the spire.
WGXC believes in hands-on, two-way radio. We provide public access to the airwaves, giving individuals and organizations the means to tell their own stories. WGXC listeners make radio, participate in on-air conversations, record public meetings for broadcast, contribute content, host their own shows, and more. The G and the C stand for Greene and Columbia counties in New York. WGXC is listener-supported, and we serve 78,000 potential local listeners in the Upper Hudson Valley, in addition to the listeners from across the globe online. Our programs can be surprising while wholesome, are very often experimental, and almost always entertaining. Program applications are accepted year-round, and no prior radio experience is required.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You can find out about so many local events, like the traditional Irish music session. Every Sunday, there's an open Irish music jam at the Shamrock House in East Durham from 2 to 5 p.m. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org and add your own event to the WGXC community calendar and have it read on the radio at 90.7 FM by going to WGXC.org and clicking on the community calendar.
from his 2023 album Wronger. Here is Hudson's Tommy Stinson with Here We Go Again.
One, two, three, four. Jumping off this roller coaster, let's find out where the exits are before we get any closer. Here we go again. Throw out your rusty pen to your old gun holster. You've been riding long enough, you could have had it reupholstered. But get yourself a new cool gun, I mean it might stick a little longer. Go stupid song. Forget about buffoonery, copyrights in perpetuity. Here we go.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Summers in Austin, Texas are scorching, but just a little ways underground, it's in the low 70s year-round. Geothermal heating and cooling systems make use of that constant temperature.
You're able to draw on that constant thermal resource that's just below your feet to either pull the heat out of the earth when it is cold, or when it's hot, to be able to sink the heat from buildings into the earth using a heat pump.
Greg Wolfson of the company EcoSmart Solution says geothermal systems have been around for a long time. They can be expensive and are typically installed one house at a time. But Wolfson's company is taking a different approach. At a new development near Austin called Whisper Valley, his team installed a community-wide geothermal system that provides heating and cooling to more than 400 homes. Underground pipes run through the whole community, with connections to each house, kind of like a municipal water system. He says the shared system is more efficient and cost-effective.
You're creating one large resource that effectively all the homes can draw upon.
So he says it's a way to provide clean heating and cooling to hundreds of new homes all at once. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
I'm Rick Smith.
And this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1952. That was the day 650,000 steelworkers walked off the job in an industry-wide strike. The Supreme Court had just handed down a 6-3 ruling in the case of Youngstown Sheet and Tube versus Sawyer. The court decided that the president had no authority to seize private property on the grounds of national security without prior authorization from Congress. On April 8th, President Harry Truman had issued Executive Order 10340, ordering Commerce Secretary Charles Sawyer to seize the nation's steel mills to ensure the continued production of steel, ostensibly for the war effort. Seizure of the mills came after months of wrangling over wage increases and work rules between mill owners, the United Steelworkers, and the Wage Stabilization Board. Steelworkers walked out just hours after the decision. The impact was felt immediately. Layoffs began at a number of steel-dependent industries. By the end of the